Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and we are coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. This is the 165th episode of the series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a highly regarded chef and restaurateur who has a long history cooking in New York City, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip. Later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. Today's tip is to form the right partnerships. Seek to work with good people who you can trust. It's important to not only have the same vision of your potential partners, but to know that they are honest people who will have your back and you will have theirs. Before signing the dotted line, seek referrals and do background checks, and always listen to your gut. It will help prevent future disputes or nasty breakups, and instead lead to long-term prosperous relationships. So partner with the right partners. That's my tip today. Now, I'm thrilled to have my guest here in the studio, someone I've known for a while through the industry. It is John DeLucy. He is the current owner of two New York City restaurants, Empire Diner, a classic diner, which he took over and revamped last April, and Bedford & Co. in the Renwick Hotel. John is the founding chef and partner of the Waverly Inn, as well as the Lion, Crown, and Bill's Food & Drink. After working a desk job for 20 years, John attended culinary school and started a career as a chef. Now, 20 years in the restaurant business, he has continued his passion to revive iconic New York City spaces with delicious food. So welcome, John.
Whoa, that's quite an introduction.
Well, I go for it.
I wish I had your advice, though. Your PR tip is rings very true in every business.
Yeah, well, thanks. I think it does. I think, I don't know. I'm like a solopreneur, I guess you'd say. Yeah, I don't have partners, but I think finding the right partners is you know, it's hard, but I think people who do it, you know, you can find great partnership relationships that, you know, make you thrive. So
yes. Yeah, it can be. Can be good.
Yeah.
It can be bad.
Can be good and bad. Mm. But anyways, let's get into how you became a chef, because as I read in the bio, you had a desk job and you left a more corporate career.
Right. Well, I was at NYU studying a lot of things, and I was also playing music. And I played guitar, and I played guitar all my whole life, actually, as a kid and in high school and then in college. And I was playing gigs around New York. And, you know, music was always my first sort of love, right? So so out of college, playing music and had a desk job, had many different kinds of jobs to sort of support myself. But I always sort of tinkered in my young years with cooking. I was, you know, I lived in my brother and I lived together in a brownstone while he was at NY, he was at SVA, I was at NYU, and we would cook for each other, and I would do the cooking, and my aunt lived upstairs, and we would go to her house one night to eat, and my other aunt was around the corner, so you know, there was a lot of family meals were had. And so I started to sort of copy, you know, the food that my mother made when we were growing up, because we had to survive, we had to eat, you know, when my aunts weren't around to cook for us.
Right.
And I sort of started to, you know, experiment and buy cookbooks and read, you know, and read the New York Times on those days. And it was on Wednesday, right? And so, and I got sort of very, very into it. I got like everything else in my life, I become obsessive. And, you know, I became really obsessed with cooking. And so when the music sort of wasn't really working out, and I found myself, you know, this is not fun being broke all the time. I thought, well, let me just, and it wasn't really fun getting up and having to shave and wear a suit either. So I thought, well, maybe I could get a job, you know, in a restaurant, because I after all, I do cook a lot. And so I didn't realize at the time that really the two things were not really, you know, they were actually mutually exclusive, right? Cooking at home and cooking in a restaurant really has nothing to do with each other.
Right. But skills that helped. Yeah.
Yeah. So I took a class at the New School, a couple of months, I think it was, and I met a really caring, talented teacher, and whose name escapes me right now, which is really embarrassing, and unfortunate, because she was terrific. And, you know, I had, you know, my whole life to that point was a lot of sort of, you know, sort of messing around. Like I never really took anything too seriously. You know, I never really practiced the guitar like I should have. I was sort of scratching the surface of a lot of different things. Having just, you know, my goal was just to have, you know, a fun time. You know, and my schoolwork was okay. I mean, I was a pretty bright kid and you know, didn't work that hard and had pretty good grades. You know, so which was ended up being, you know, it really hurts you in the end. But anyway, I enrolled in this class, and Karen, the teacher, sort of pulled me aside one day and said to me, you know, you can't just, you know, I see that in your life you get what you want,
yeah,
just because you're so charming and cute.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's not really going to happen here. And she made it very clear that wasn't really, you know, in the cards for me in that class. And she really held me accountable, and she really was tough on me. And at the end of the class, she introduced me to her then husband, who was a chef at a restaurant on 60th and 3rd. And he basically hired me on the spot. And that was in 1990.
Wow, okay.
So it was a long time ago. So that was... you know, I sort of knew that this cooking thing was kind of for me.
Yeah, you know? Well, I mean, unfortunately, my memory is horrible, but I read your book,
yes,
The Hunger.
The Hunger.
It came out, what, in 2000, like,
12.
12, but it was,
12, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, not that long ago.
Not that long ago.
But it was, and going through, I mean, maybe to refresh my memory then, mm-hmm, through your, because you worked in a lot of New York City establishments,
yes,
and then there were people that came across along the way, like Missy Robbins, right?
Yes, yes.
That you worked with. And
yeah, yeah.
It was a fun read, because all of a sudden it was putting people I knew in the industry
right,
together
right,
along your career path.
Yes, Missy was my sous chef at the Soho Grand. Amanda Freitag was my sous chef,
yeah,
at the Tribeca Grand. I had the absolute, you know, good fortune to work with just some of the most talented people, you know, absolutely. Missy and Amanda being two of them. So, yeah, I had look, a lot of good luck in the restaurant business.
So once you started the job on 60th Street, and then, mm-hmm, were you committed, this is it, I want to be a chef, I'm going to go on my path and stick with this? Because, I mean, you have.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was really just... happy to not be going to work in a suit in the morning, and whatever was going to come of this new venture,
mm-hmm,
I wasn't really thinking about too much. I was thinking about sort of just getting to work the next day and sort of, you know, learning as much as I could. And I would go in very early, and I would learn how, you know, to butcher chickens, and then I would stay late to make the pizza dough, and then the next day I would work with the butcher and learn how to, you know, to break down fish. So, I mean, I was really, again, I became obsessed with the business of of restaurants. And I just really worked, you know, night and day, you know, and tried to sort of learn as much as I possibly could, because I was coming to the business, you know, kind of late. I was almost 30 years old at that point. I was, you know, 10 years older than everyone else, you know, than every other cook that I was working with. So it was important for me to sort of make up that time quickly.
Yeah. So what restaurants that you worked at would you say, like, I'm not defined your career, just kind of pushed you along, being from someone who was just took a few cooking classes to where you've gotten to today, where you're a restaurateur and owner, and you've had some very huge restaurants, very, you know, notable places that you've worked with.
Well, I worked with people like, you know, David Walzog at Arizona 206. You know, we got 3 stars in the New York Times. I worked with this guy, Rick Lakanen, at a place called Lux, also three stars in the New York Times. I worked with Rick Moonen at Oceana. I mean, I tried to be a sponge and I tried to learn as much as I could. Ultimately, you know, the fine dining thing wasn't really for me. I didn't really enjoy it that much. You know, I wanted a little bit more of a looser environment. And so that's when I sort of, you know, I worked at the Soho Grand, the Tribeca Grand, and then I find myself, you know, in the middle of these sort of celebrity, if for lack of a better word, sort of celebrity sceney places, which I really liked.
Yeah, but how does that happen? I mean, how did the Waverly Inn come about?
Well, I was a chef at a restaurant called La Bottega, which is in the Maritime Hotel, which is La Serena now.
Yeah, I remember.
And I was simply having the time of my life. I was a young guy in a huge hotel with a lot of young people working there, and we were just, you know, we were partying and having fun. And so my bosses at the Maritime were Eric Good and Sean McPherson, who were just, you know, again, two super talented, you know, visionary kind of guys. And they were designers and they were restaurateurs. And Sean had a bunch of places in L.A. and he had a very sort of California, decidedly California style, which I loved, you know, and Eric also. And so I was there and at La Bottega for about 4 years, I guess. And then I went out and I left La Bottega and went out to L.A. and worked for Sean at a bunch of his L.A. restaurants.
I don't remember that.
Yes. And so then when I came back, a friend of mine said, you know, this Waverly Inn is for rent. You should really go and check it out. And I was like, well, this is, you know, I met the landlord and I brought Sean McPherson into the mix. And Sean brought Graydon Carter into it because Graydon lived two doors down from the Waverly. And so we all had a meeting and we all decided we would open the Waverly Inn.
And it became, I mean, it was an instant, I think, from my perspective, hot spot, like the hardest reservation to get in.
Right. Which you know, which in retrospect was really all about Graydon, because Graydon was, was the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. So anyone on the cover of Vanity Fair was having dinner at the Waverly Inn. So it was pretty, it was really quite cool.
It was
amazing. And I was a partner there. And so it was just an amazing sort of, situation where there was lightning in a bottle, you know, and it was just nothing like it before in New York in many, many years. There'll probably be nothing like it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then, well, maybe we'll take a break now and we'll talk a bit. We'll get into the other projects you were involved with, the Lion and what you're doing now with the Empire Diner and all these very iconic restaurants and that have it, like, they make statements in New York, I believe. So
we hope.
I think so. So let's take a little break and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
And we're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is John DeLucy. He's the chef and owner of Empire Diner and Bedford & Co. in New York City. And he's formerly, we were talking about the Waverly Inn, the Lion, the Crown, and Bill's. I mean, this is only a 45-minute show. I don't know how much we can jump into all that. But those are, I mean, maybe, I mean, if you want to touch on any comments on working in those restaurants, which are all, I mean, I had fantastic experiences at all of them.
Great, I mean, great fun. Lion was absolutely great fun. Lion came right after the Waverly Inn. And an iconic space.
Very cool space.
Yeah, on 9th Street. And I could, you know, I could just tell, it just, again, it came together. And it was a very sceney hotspot with really terrific food, I thought. The many critics will, you know, will disagree with that. But it was a super fun place. And, you know, that's really, for me, that's what it's all about. People coming, sitting down, sharing a meal, sharing drink, and having just a fantastic time.
Yeah, and that's what it should be about.
That's what it's, you know, that's my goal.
How would you define your cooking or now, or did it change over the years? Is there a style you think you brought through all of these restaurants?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my cooking is populist. You know, I really sort of listen to the guest and the consumer and see what the trend is and see what people are eating and try to deliver on, you know, a promise of comfort and, you know. Again, it's a fun thing. It's not a challenging. I'm not doing any hot cuisine. I'm not doing anything that's, you know, any out there. I'm just trying to do, you know, use the best ingredients, and creating food that's accessible and simple and delicious. And that's, I know it's I'm oversimplifying it a little bit. Maybe I'm not. I don't know. But that's been the goal always.
Yeah. Well, now, so Bedford and Co. is at the Renwick Hotel.
Yep.
And are you servicing the entire hotel, breakfast, lunch, dinner?
Breakfast, yes. Full three meal periods, room service. We have a wood burning grill, which is just fantastic, and it's American, but it's, you know, it's also the chef de cuisine there is Justin Newbick, and he's just a young guy that's, you know, that we collaborate on a lot of stuff, and you know, this is, to me, it's always been a very young business, and I love bringing young people into it and sort of sharing ideas and collaborating. And he's just one of these guys that's just really bright and really creative and a joy to work with.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. He's been with me now for about 7 years.
Oh, that's great. And what about Empire Diner? So how did you end up running the ship over there?
Let me figure this out. So, my partner in Lion, Mark, owned the last iteration of the Empire Diner, and was selling it, and he actually ended up selling it to his partner in cafeteria, Stacy. And I get a call from Stacy, and who I'd known for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
And said, "Hey, this is right up your alley. Why don't you do this with us?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And she said, "You know, come on, let's talk." So we talked about it, and we figured it out, and so I'm yes, and we did a deal.
So, it's an iconic diner. It's been around.
Since the 40s.
And then a few years ago, it was Amanda Freitag was cooking.
Yes.
I went the other night, just so you know.
You did?
I did.
How was it?
It was great.
Oh, good.
I popped in by myself, sat at the bar. I went to see what you were doing.
Right.
So I had...
you didn't let me know next time.
Well, I figured it was a Sunday night and I asked for you, but I was sort of... Yeah, I just wanted to check it out, and I had the crispy artichokes, which were fantastic.
Oh, good!
And a beef tartare, and
that's my favorite dish.
They went really well together.
Yeah,
actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I just figured I'd pop in and see what was happening. I mean, the space, the staff, everything. It's a really great restaurant.
It's a cool space in a very cool neighborhood on a great corner. You know, it's all got a lot of things in its favor over there. The neighborhood is really emerging. There's lots of new buildings, lots of affluent people and who like to eat out. And you always like to have a restaurant in a neighborhood like that.
Right. And I overheard someone near me commenting about how it was happy with all the Christmas lights or the white Christmas lights. It's glowing when you walk up to the diner.
Well, it's got a lot of history. I mean, I was there, just to give away my age, but I was there, you know, in college. And I remember going out to Area one night. And we'd go to there and ordered, you know, some crazy thing that they had on, think of it. But anyway, so at, you know, in the place, you know, where Deborah Harry, you know, Lou Reed, and what's his name? The New York Dolls guy, Johansson. Well, you know, they're all hanging out there. It was a very cool happening spot, you know, even back then. When 10th Avenue and 20th Century was not the place to sort of be walking around,
right?
You know,
well, what's the challenge of taking over such a classic diner? It's been around, and people's expectations. And I mean, is it hard to do a menu?
It is because everybody has their memory of, hey, oh, you know, even though this is an issue at the Waverly, also is, oh, are you going to have those biscuits? Are you going to have the, you know. Well, maybe, I don't know. I mean, it's not really wasn't the plan, you know, but maybe we should now, you know, but everybody has a memory of what they ate at the diner when they were, you know, when they were 20. And that isn't necessarily part of the plan, you know, so they're disappointed. And so you try to just, do a menu where there it's familiar enough and there's stuff, you know, where you can, you know, have a, again, there's a lot of kids now. There wasn't a lot of kids there going there in those days. So now, you know, we make sure we have, you know, kids' menu. We make sure we have, a little something for everyone.
I wasn't sure if you really meant kids or you meant like 20-year-old kids. But
no,
you
meant children.
Kids.
Yes.
Yeah, I picked
that
up.
There are the other kind of kids there are there.
yeah, both.
Yeah.
So let me ask you my question from my last guest. So on episode 164, I had on Eric Asimov, the wine critic of the New York Times.
Fancy.
Very fancy. Mm. It's great. Go check out episode 164. Yeah. Okay, so he wants to know, as the owner of Empire Diner, what's happened to New York's diner culture? Mm. He said, you don't see that many diners and lunch counters anymore. Is it a real estate issue or a changing taste issue? We reminisced a little bit about some old school diners.
Yeah, I don't think it's a changing tastes issue. I think that people are always gonna want to eat eggs all day long. I think there's always gonna be a segment of the population that has breakfast at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But I think it's more and more difficult to be able to sustain that as a business. You know, it's rent is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Labor, you know, is out of control. Minimum wage is out of control. So, you know, it becomes more and more difficult to operate, you know, on a all day menu when your average cost or average check is very, very low. And that's just not going to, it's not sustainable any longer. I think it's, you know, people love diners. People want to be able to go to diners. They just no one can afford to have them anymore.
Yeah, well, there's your answer, Eric. So before we take one more break here, let me ask you, what's next? Like, are you good right now with running these two places? Are you seeking new opportunities? Or
should we want to answer now, or should we have a break?
I wouldn't answer now, unless you need a break. or we could just stay tuned, you know,
to see what's next. I'm about to be a father.
You are?
Which, yes.
That's amazing.
For the first time at my ripe old age. It's you know, all consuming. And so, you know, I think a lot more about that than I do about, you know, roast chicken right now. But but I'm always, you know, pursuing and looking and meeting and talking to people about new things and new opportunities. And, you know, I love with what's happening with fast casual, how, you know, how Market has just opened, Pasta Flyer.
Yeah, which got a nice review. Yeah. I mean, it was in the Times today.
And he is just a brilliant chef. And you know, it's so cool that kind of thing is happening. So, you know, who knows what the future will bring, but I'm very optimistic.
Okay. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
And now we're going to take another break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to play my speed round game.
Uh-oh.
And talk some industry news.
Okay.
This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
And we're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is John DeLucy. It's time for my speed round game. What this is I name a couple of things, and you pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Okay. Chocolate.
Me too. Not chocolate. Okay. That was the example, but okay. Now I know you're a chocolate guy.
Yes.
Okay. How about eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Wine.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Large plates.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Chef's counter.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Tipping.
Truffle mac and cheese or mac and cheese with breadcrumbs?
Both.
I like it. Very fair. Cooking for celebrities or food critics?
Celebrities.
Two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
It depends. Can I have a depends?
You can. You've been so speedy and fast at this. Yes. You can have a depends.
Depends.
Depends on what?
Depends on what I ate for dinner.
Sometimes, very interesting.
Sometimes I want sweet. Sometimes cheese just works.
I think that's the first time someone's given that rendition on that, and I think it's. I'm surprised because I think it's a great answer.
Yeah, I love cheese.
Okay, one more.
Yep.
Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Ooh. See, that's tough because I'm from Brooklyn and I've lived in Manhattan since college. So I'm really torn about that.
Would you move back to Brooklyn?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I might live
that's in, like
I,
an extra.
I live in the West Village. I live in a very cool, nice place. But Brooklyn is Brooklyn's coming on, man. I mean, it's coming on. It's gone. It's gone. It's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear you.
I love Brooklyn.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll leave that one as a tie, too.
All right.
That was great. That was the game.
Yep.
Okay, so industry news. Big news happened. Sad big news. But two sad stories I have today. Totally different. First is on Saturday, Paul Bocuse passed away. And he was 91.
91, though.
He was 91. Actually, 91. I was reading the article, and his birthday was coming up in February. Yeah. So he was almost 92.
91. And he had a wife and a mistress.
I think he had two mistresses.
Two mistresses.
Yeah.
I think he's good. I think he died a happy man. I think he's all right.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, the article I picked out, there were many, but it was in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. William Grimes wrote a lovely piece, lots of details about the mistresses and everything in there. I mean, he was, you know, every my entire Instagram, Facebook feed turned into Paul Bocuse on Saturday because he was a legend and he affected the whole industry and so many chefs and so many people, and he was apparently, a lot of this, he was a big self-promoter and how he got his name out there with what he was doing over the years. And establishing the Bocuse d'Or.
And he was very controversial, and he was a good guy. He was a cool guy and talented, and could back it up, and was opinionated.
Mm-hmm.
And he's someone to really hold in high esteem.
Yeah,
our business.
I agree. Yeah. I went to his restaurant in Lyon.
Yes, as did I.
When were you there about?
I was there in, I'll tell you, it was there in 1990.
Okay. I was there, it was 6 years ago, and I had been on a trip with meeting my family in Paris for my father's birthday, and I went to Lyon by myself for 2 days to go check out Paul Bocuse's restaurant in the town, which was lovely. And I had such a great experience. He came, he walked around the dining room. He said hi to everyone, including me. He sat across the way with his friends. It was special. So, but yeah, you said 1990?
Quite a long time ago. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have a limited memory of it because I was rather naive about food in those days because I had just sort of started. But I remember going to Lyon and seeking it out because it was one of the things I was reading about then. And some of the the people that we should he was one of the people that we should know and sort of know about. So I went to the restaurant and had lunch actually, and it was lovely. It was a lovely experience and
Wow. Mm. Yeah, that's...
It's also a long time ago.
It is, but yeah, whatever you remember, you took with you he had a great life. He's left his mark.
Yes,
so,
for sure.
But, it's sad. It's sad still. So, the other sad news, which is completely, completely different on the spectrum, is that an article I have in the New York Times about how Sever magazine has laid off 6 people, including its editor-in-chief, Adam Sachs.
Mm-hmm. And who I know very well.
Who I know, too, came on my show sometime, I think, last year. And they laid off a lot of, very talented people who've worked at the magazine. The staff is apparently down to 6 people. And this is... I never know how to pronounce it. Is it Bonnier or Bonnier Corporation, the parent company? Bonnier? Bonnier?
I don't know.
There were layoffs with other of their publications.
Bonnier.
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 All right.
Bonnier. Bon.
I think people will be able to figure it out what we're talking about. So that company.
Yes.
Well, I think the publishing industry, it's struggling. And
well, magazines are a lot like restaurants. It becomes very, very difficult with costs being what they are and readership being what it is. And, you've got to pay an editor like you got to pay a chef and you have to pay writers like you have to pay cooks. And the labor gets to be very, very expensive. And the advertising dollars are just not there like they used to be. No one's advertising in print when they could advertise, on Google or in social media. And there's so many other ways, to get – there's so many other, avenues of advertising. And it just doesn't go to the magazines anymore. And it's very, very sad because, we love these glossy magazines. We love the reporting They were doing something special, Savor.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. And I think, I think people, I still want to pick up a great magazine with great content and get the physical magazine. Everything has gone towards digital and, we'll see what I'm sure Adam and the rest of the staff will find their way. Mm-hmm. And
well, we hope, I mean, the talented people do find their way.
Yeah. And it's just, the issue that said Sever is going down to 4 issues a year from 6. And there was something in there, too, just saying how someone had said how the staff, they've been slowly cutting the staff. This wasn't just all of a sudden a drastic thing, but apparently a few years ago it was a staff of 20 and it's dwindled down. So I think they knew, but I don't know. I'm hoping for the best. I don't want food publications or any publications just to completely disappear.
Yes. No, that's a sad thing. It is. And especially the ones that are someone like that, which again was really focused on quality mm-hmm. and ingredients and creativity.
Yes, I agree. Okay, we're going to take one more break, come back, I'm going to do my solo dining experience, and we'll have the final question. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. This week's, it's at Shoji at 69 Leonard Street. Here's the rundown. The location, 69 Leonard Street, Tribeca, New York. The concept, seasonal capo-style kaseki and edamame sushi menu by a Tokyo and Kyoto-trained chef. Who's the chef? Derek Wilson, and the owner, Idan Elkon. So why did I go? Because I was craving a top omakase experience and ready to splurge. My experience. So I made a reservation for one for an 8:30 p.m. reservation. I was warmly greeted by Idan and well taken care of the entire meal. I was seated sort of in the middle of the sushi counter near the chef. And I was, you know, it was always fun watching the chef at work. Kaseki dishes and dessert came from the back kitchen, and the sushi was prepared right in front of me. So what did I get? Okay, so the set menu started with about four or five composed kaseki dishes, including beautiful scallops, raw and cooked fish, a rare hairy crab, and octopus. There were two soups, and Chef Wilson's meticulous sushi came after, and then there were two desserts. I also had some lovely teas, including a matcha. My take. It was absolutely wonderful from start to finish. My favorites were the crab and the toro and otoro sushi. The ambiance. So it's an intimate, modern, and simplistic 12-seat sushi counter. It's perfect for sushi lovers and solo diners. Interesting tidbit. Idan initially opened the space with Chef Ichimura, but they had a bad split, apparently, after 6 months, and he brought on Chef Wilson, and this is Chef Wilson's first New York City restaurant experience because he had been training in Japan for a decade, and Chef Wilson is the first and only Westerner to complete a full seven-year apprenticeship at a traditional Japanese kaseki restaurant, three-starred Michelin Kikunoyu, if I'm saying that right, in Kyoto. Personal fun fact, so this is kind of silly, but several weeks ago I was going to Tetsu by myself and it was a freezing night and I accidentally walked into Shoji, which is across the street looking for Tetsu, and that is when I met Idan and we chatted a few minutes and realized that we knew each other through social media and I told him I'd be back and so I was, this time at the right place. The cost of this meal was $274, and that is including everything, including the tax and gratuity, and the teas were comped. Would I go back? Yes, when I'm feeling wealthy. The website is 69leonardstreet.com. There you have it. What do you think? Omakase?
Sure.
When someone else is paying?
Yes. Definitely when someone else is paying. Although yeah. I'm usually paying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is a pricey one, yeah. But it was special and I appreciated it. So. Yeah. Okay. So it's time for the final question. So next week, my guest is Jim Leahy. I love Jim Leahy. I love Jim Leahy
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
And he's a current client of mine. Is full he? Disclosure. Yes.
I have all his books. I cook all his breads. I'm going to leave you photos. Show him. See how I'm doing.
Okay. Yeah. I made No Need Bread for the first time a few weeks ago.
Works.
It works. Mm. I figured I should try it out yep. if I'm working with this guy. No, it's brilliant.
He's a genius. He's yeah. a genius. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
His place Co is in my neighborhood and right by the diner. And I go
Oh, it is.
I go
yeah.
I go all the time.
Yeah, so for people listening, Jim Leahy has Sullivan Street Bakery. There's two in New York. Actually, the one in Hell's Kitchen is currently under construction, but there's a pop-up across the street. He opened a wholesale space down in Miami, which will be retail at one point. And he has Co, or company restaurant, which is he has his pizza, and mm-hmm. it's all wood-fired
yep.
dishes. Okay, there's Jim's background, and you know Jim and love Jim. And
I don't know Jim.
Like?
I don't know Jim.
You don't know Jim?
I mean, I think I've met Jim once.
You're going to have to meet him.
I'll meet him, yeah, because I do like his product very much.
I always figure after all these years, you know, the chefs, you guys meet each other, know
yeah,
each other.
Yeah, but not really because we're working all the time, right. You know? So that's true.
Yeah, I guess the events help with
the
that
events,
if
yeah.
you have time to mm-hmm. schmooze a little.
Right.
Okay, so what would you like to ask Jim? It could be anything.
I know everything about Jim from his books, I think. But I would love to have coffee with Jim.
So that's the question.
Yeah.
Jim, would you like to have coffee with me?
That's the question, yes.
Okay, I think I know what the answer is.
Okay, good.
I hope, yeah.
You might know, you may not know.
I might know. My guess, I think I'm going to be right with what I'm thinking the answer good. Is. Mm. But, well, people, you'll have to stay tuned.
I'll have to just stay tuned. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And that's the show.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Good. It's nice to be in Brooklyn.
Yeah, it is. Mm. And, you know, you're an impressive guy. And I
really?
Feel, yeah, you are. And I feel, no, over the
well,
years,
nice.
I've known you from events and from going to your restaurants.
Yes.
And I've enjoyed your cooking and everything you've done. And I wish you much continued success.
That's very nice. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. No, I mean it. Yes. I mean it. And congratulations again on your baby. That's exciting.
It is. It's terrifying.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it's exciting. You have a lot going on.
Yes.
So thank you.
Yes.
And people should go check out your restaurants now. So I've been talking to John DeLucy. He's the chef and owner of Empire Diner and Bedford & Co. They're in New York City. And their websites are empire-diner.com and bedfordandco.com. And John's website is johndelucy.com. You can also follow him on social media at Chef John DeLucy. Did I get all that right?
Got it.
Okay, good. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. Website's BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com. And all of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes and Stitcher, so you can listen at any time. Thanks to John. Thanks to Anna. And
thanks
to Vitor, my engineer, who does a fabulous job every
He's
week for me.
He's killing it in there.
Yes. Thank you, Vitor. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next Wednesday with another live show. I hope you'll tune in then. And thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please Join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.